All right, welcome back to another episode of The Outlander here on Hearthfire Radio with me, your host, Mike Maxwell. And today, I just wanted to talk about something that's been on my mind, something that's very relevant these days for me personally, and that is the culture thug. So, as many of you will know, my book, which has been in the works for many years, The Culture Thug Handbook, is now nigh. It's just about here, and by the time this episode drops, and by the time many of you will get around to watching it, it will be out. So, for anybody that's watching in the future, you can go to imperiumpress.org/cth, and that will direct you right to the page on the website where you can buy it. And I am very proud of this book. It's been a long time coming. There's kind of a story behind it, which is that, and it's been in the works for so long now, several years, that I can't remember exactly when, but I think it was 2020, where my good friend and comrade Dave Martell and I had been talking, and I don't think Culture Dads started at this point, but we'd certainly done a number of podcasts together. We were friends by this time, and you know, I'd been on the podcast circuit for a little while. I'd been sort of making the rounds, sort of promoting Imperium and getting to become a bit of a known figure in the scene. And one of the things that I was starting to be known for, actually, is being able to explain things, complicated ideas, in ways, you know, that the folks at home can understand. You know, specifically when it comes to paganism, especially, you know, the classical world and Rome in particular, but in general, whether it's illiberal concepts, you know, things like the high-low versus middle mechanism, things like the state of exception, the friend-enemy distinction, thrownness, cyclical history, all of this stuff. So this is something that I was starting to be known for, is basically like the guy who can break this stuff down into very digestible language. So Dave pitched me an idea. He basically said, Mike, why don't you write just a little pamphlet thing or whatever, just a little book, not even a book, but just a quick little thing that like guys can put in their pocket and take with them, where it just kind of lays out any number of these concepts, any number of these like illiberal ideas, in, you know, that so that like 100 IQ normies, guys who do not have any background in like political stuff or religion like theology or anything like that, why don't you write a book so that guy can get a hold of what it is that we believe? Because there's a lot of people out there who are just coming into this thing now, you know, 2020, all the shenanigans that was going on at that time and are still going on. You know, it's an election year right now. Why don't you write a book for that guy, for the guy who's just come into this thing and is like, holy crap, there's this whole other world of like stuff outside of my worldview. But you know, a lot of it is kind of embedded in this like meme culture, densely sort of walled off behind 1,000 word gigantic doorstop of a book kind of works. Why don't you write a book for that guy who can kind of just give, you can just give him, you know, a little taste of what things, what we're about and like what our worldview is and all of that stuff. So I thought to myself, that's a great idea. So I kind of squirreled it away and started making notes and things like that. And, you know, nobody's interested in the writing process, so I won't go into that. But basically, the thing continued, I started doing that. I started making notes. Okay, let's talk about this. Okay, well, let's, you know, let's talk about the deep state. Oh, well, what about, the cathedral and this and that and this and that. All these things that I find myself constantly making reference to in interviews and having to kind of give a little overview of like what that is. I started jotting it down, making a list. And eventually over time, things, got out of hand and got to the point where I had a list of 45 things, 45 concepts or, you know, ideas that needed to be explained. And I started working my way through them. And I have to say a thank you here to everybody, you know, who has bought books from us. Everybody, especially folks that have signed up to the Substack and the Gumroad, all the culture dads, all the guys that read the Substack day in or week in and week out, and have been with us for a while, thank you so much, because it was you who basically allowed me to have the time to write this book, really, as beyond just publishing books, which, believe me, I mean, guys think it's easy, but it takes a lot of time. So all of this extra stuff, in addition to putting out books, the Substack, the Gumroad, you know, guys made that possible. It got to be this gigantic beast that over time I just chipped away at, and over a period of years it has now been finished and it's ready to be released, and I'm really excited about it. I think that this book has the potential to really open up a new vista of people coming into our thing, but not exactly the kind of people that something like the Populist Delusion would bring in, or the old one that we put out, the Chris Bond's Nemesis. That is more geared towards an academic crowd. That's more geared towards people who are already kind of familiar, though they know who Carl Schmitt is. They've maybe heard of Gaetano Mosca. They've maybe heard of Sam Francis and Paul Gottfried and all this. Now, of course, Populist Delusion is an explainer book, and so is the Culture Thug Handbook, but Culture Thug is a little bit different because it is aimed at the culture thug. That's why it's called that. It is aimed at the man who looks and acts like a man but wants to learn something about the history of ideas but maybe doesn't have the time to read 10,000 pages worth of stuff over a course of years. You know, he's got a family, he goes to the gym, he does MMA, he's, you know, goes out with his drinking, but he's got time, he doesn't have time for that. He doesn't have time for the autistic stuff that we do. This book is for him. This book is basically to get him up to speed with everything that it is that we're about and everything it is that what we believe. I want to say something about what the cultured thug is first, beyond that little thumbnail sketch. This is the phrase cultured thug goes back to Jonathan Bowden, and many of you guys know Jonathan Bowden. He was a supremely gifted orator who came in about 10 years before our thing, before the so-called alt-right got started. Really back at the time when the energy in illiberal politics and dissident right-wing movements was very low, where it was really just the lifers. It was really just the folks like Jared Taylor, the guys who were really committed ideologically, and the true giants were doing it because nobody else was. You know, this was before Donald Trump. Bowden died in 2012, so he died well before the explosion of the alt-right or anything like that. But he was that guy before that guy was a thing. And he came up with the phrase, the cultured thug, in one of his speeches. If you don't know Jonathan Bowden, go look up his speeches. You'll thank me later. He's a treasure trove. In one of his speeches, he mentions the cultured thug. And the cultured thug, he says, is Byron's ideal. And this took me a while to unpack because, you know, most of you who know who Byron is, Byron was a 18th century poet. I think it was 18th century, maybe 19th. But anyway, he was a romantic poet, a British gentleman who most people know when they hear the word, the name Byron, they think of the Byronic hero, which is not actually what is meant exactly by the cultured thug. The cultured thug is Byron himself. Now, Byron was a poet, a man of letters, a romantic, a lover, a fighter, and he was also a soldier. So he was a man of intellect and a man of words and a man of ideas, but he was also a man of violence. He was a man who was not afraid to fight and die, and he did. He fought and died young, in the Middle East, actually. So Byron himself is the sort of the type of the cultured thug. Now, in the prologue to my book, the very first concept I explain is the cultured thug, and the example I give is Aeschylus. Some of you may know Aeschylus as the poet of the Oresteia. He is the first tragedian, the first writer of Greek tragedy. He wrote his Oresteia, which is the only complete trilogy of Greek tragedy that we have that's come down to us. Truly one of the titans of Western literature, a wonderful writer and an amazing poet, but he was also a soldier, as most Greek men were at that of his station. Most Greek men of his class and time and place were soldiers. But something interesting about Aeschylus is that despite that everybody remembers him today as a poet, as a writer, as a tragedian, as a dramatist, despite all that, when he died and was buried, he had inscribed on his tombstone something like, "Here lies Aeschylus of wherever he was from, I forget. He will be remembered, but he will especially be remembered by the long-haired Persian whom he killed in such great numbers." Something like that. That's a very rough kind of paraphrase. On his tombstone, he did not want to be remembered as the winner of the prize of the great contests of tragedy. He wanted to be remembered as a killer of men, as a soldier, as a defender of his folk. He wanted to be remembered as a thug. He didn't want to be remembered as a cultured man. I'm sure he did, but first and foremost, as a man of violence. And I think that that tells you something about the cultured thug. The cultured thug has been with us for a very long time. And indeed, the further back you go, the more often you meet him, which is why evil people do not want you to learn anything about history. Now, there are other cultured thugs in our day, in our time, and I think some of them would take issue with that term, but, you know, it's a polemical term, so take it for what it's worth. You could think of someone like Tolkien, who needs no introduction, but as a soldier, he needs no introduction as a writer, but as a soldier, he fought in World War I, he fought at the Battle of the Somme, which is one of the bloodiest battles of that war, which is a almost historically unique tragedy for what folks thought they were going to get when they went into it, which is heroism and glory, and what they did get out of it, which was basically being thrown into a meat grinder. the Sum was the absolute lowest point of that. And he fought there. He fought and in the trenches. He knew about trench warfare. He contracted trench fever, in fact. He was a warrior as much as he was a writer and a man of letters, a man of ideas. You could think of somebody like Wittgenstein, who is not talked about enough on the right, but that's another story. He also fought in World War I. He fought for the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so he fought on the other side of Tolkien. And he fought on the other side of the front as well. He fought on the Eastern Front, which was perhaps, you know, in, as a whole, I mean, the Somme was terrible, but the Eastern Front was one of the bloodiest and most grinding fronts in that whole war. Again, a unique kind of tragedy as it was. And his experience in war no doubt colored his writing of the Tractatus Logico Philosophicus, which is essentially the opening salvo, it's let's just say it's the sophomore smash of analytic philosophy. Frege is really the birth of it, but Wittgenstein was where analytic philosophy really came into its own and became an institution. And his book, the Tractatus Logico Philosophicus, was written on the front. He wrote this epoch-making work of philosophy while he was fighting in the trenches and fighting in some of the worst battles of all. So there's a cultured thug for you. And perhaps most of all, you could think of somebody like a Julius Caesar as perhaps the archetypal cultured thug who, I mean, his name is just, it's a Caesar. It's like an adjective now, Caesarian or a Caesarist. Like, here was a man who, although he didn't rise from nothing, he certainly came from a good family, absolutely astonished everybody in one of the most impressive civilizations ever to exist. Rose like a meteoric rise to prominence, slaughtered a million Gauls in France and the Western Europe. But at the same time, he's also the best source for what we know about the Gauls, because not only was he a killer, he was also a man of intelligence, a man of a great writer, a great orator, just genius of a strategist, a genius politician, an overall genius in every imaginable way. So, you know, I think you know what I'm saying when I'm talking about the cultured thug and the kind of man that this book is aimed at. Culture thug. We need him like we need air today. His absence is sorely missed. His presence is sorely missed. His absence is very, very strongly felt. The way that Bowden describes it in that very same talk where he coins the phrase is that those who have courage today, those who have courage have no intellect, and those who have intellect have no courage, which is a sobering thought. The cultured thug is that. The cultured thug is the man who has both. He is the man who has the courage to do what is right, but also the intellect to know what needs to be done. And this book is aimed at him. We need him today. And I mentioned Caesar. I mentioned Caesar as kind of the type of the cultured thug. We need a Caesar today. It's part of the civilizational cycle, the stage that we find ourselves in that cycle. You know, it comes out of Spengler, who's one of the people that I explain in the Cultured Thug Handbook. I go through his whole cyclical history, where, you know, most of you are familiar with this, but a civilization functions very much like an organism, or one of the other analogies that he gives is the analogy of the seasons, where a people is born, there's a springtime. This is the sort of vitalistic age where the people come screaming out of the barbarian hinterlands, dream heavy, sure of itself, absolutely unconcerned with any other people. The other peoples are basically fodder to be mowed down. And then this springtime civilization comes to the summer, where it becomes a little bit more sedentary, a little bit more rooted, a little bit more reflective. This is the time of a reformation. This is the time where it's unconscious, or preconscious folkways come into question. It starts to think about them critically, although still not as critically as it will. This is the time of urbanization. This is the time of settling down. And then after this, we get the autumn. And the autumn is the real time of questioning, the time where everything is thrown into question, the time where a people becomes completely self-reflective and critical of itself. And this is also the time of high culture, the flourishing of this people, even though the flourishing is kind of, it's like a fuel that's being spent at the expense of the people, which will be, which will die as a result of it. This is the autumn, this is the Enlightenment, this is the classical era in Greece, and so on. But after that comes something much darker. After that we get the winter. And the winter is the time where all of the juice has been squeezed out of the culture. All of the moves have been made. All of the questions have been asked and answered over and over and over again, exhaustively. This is where you get the rise of science and techniques. Not the rise of science. Science comes during the autumn, but where science becomes the prevailing mode of understanding the world, and technicality and instrumentalization become par for the course, I guess, shall we say. And the only way, because the culture is no longer vital, it's essentially a kind of ossified skeleton that no longer has any vitality. The only way that it can survive is by empire, is by expanding into other people's territory and essentially appropriating them for its own ends. And the only way that empire can work, the only way that that fuel can keep being fed into the machine, is by essentially deputizing the energy and will of the people, which is why you get the rise of mass politics, democracy, things like that. And with the rise of mass politics, the law becomes formalized, everything becomes hardened into a kind of inflexible structure. Politics becomes more and more aggravated, more and more contentious, and eventually the whole machine grinds to a halt and comes to a point of gridlock, where no more moves are possible, not even any intellectual or cultural moves are possible. Not only is that not possible, that's long in the past, but not even any political moves forward are utterly impossible. and you have essentially a kind of stasis or gridlock. I think you guys have an idea of what I'm talking about, because we are living in that gridlock right now at this very moment. And the only thing that can break that gridlock, the only thing that can cut the Gordian knot, is a Caesar. And the only man who can become a Caesar is the cultured thug. So we need him. The cultured thug is long overdue for us. And so his time is nigh, and I wrote this book to help foster him. The man who can think, but who can also fight, and who will fight, who has the will to go down swinging if necessary, but who has the competence to prevail so that he doesn't go down at all, and that he brings down your enemies. So I hope that this book plays some small part in bringing that Caesar into this world, because we need him. We need him like we've never needed him before. So, folks, thank you for watching, and pick up the book if you have a mind to. I think you're really going to like it. It's basically all of my takes, all of my hot takes, all of my best, you know, ideas jammed into one 100,000 word screed, and I think it's going to be something. So, once again, thanks for watching, folks, and we'll see you on the next episode.